T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Hey, everybody. Good afternoon. Welcome to a fresh, live, and in-person edition of Law Talk. Good afternoon to all of you in this time zone. If you happen to be listening on the internet and you're in a different time zone, good morning or whatever the case may be. I am Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We are live, and the best news of all is that means that we are all set to take your phone calls, your legal questions, comments, issues. We will be dispensing legal information, legal advice, trying to help you with whatever legal issue that you might have. Just remember, if you're thinking about should I call up or not call up, if you allow us to help you on the air, you're also helping a whole bunch of other folks that are listening and probably have a similar issue and can benefit from it. So don't be shy. We are happy to hear from you at 860-522-9842. If you remember the letters, it's 860-522-WTIC. What a coincidence. So we are here right up until 1 o'clock, and then it's news, sports, and weather, and then pet talk after that. We'd be delighted to hear from you, help you on the air. But in the meantime, let me tell you what we have lined up, because we've always got some legal vignettes, some legal stories that are carefully curated to try to make them interesting for you. And to the extent we can with each one, there's going to be a takeaway, something that this particular story, this particular case tells you and every one of us that we may be able to use in our own everyday activities. Okay, so here's the lineup for today. First of all, we've had a couple of questions, especially back in my private practice, about when somebody dies as a result of someone else's actions. Take a car accident, for example, and there's a lawsuit. It's called a wrongful death lawsuit. Well, how in the world does the judge or the jury calculate the damages? What's a person's life worth? That is a great question. The law addresses that very specifically, so we're going to go through some of that, and you'll have a little better idea of how it works out. Under no circumstances is it guesswork. It's highly developed, and when you hear how it works, I think you'll understand that it's pretty fair, not only to the estate of the person who died, but also to the person who caused the death, often unintentionally, often accidentally. So we'll be going into some of that, teaching you how that works, and then moving on to a couple of other topics. Next one after that, supposing that you had a trial at court and you got caught with some deceptive behavior and the trial judge wrote about it. Well, fast forward 20 years later, you're now back in court with someone else suing you. Can they bring up that previous conduct and the judge's remarks? Most of us are going to say, nah, not relevant to the issues. Well, Judge Alvin Thompson of the U.S. District Court took a slightly different view, and we're going to talk about that. There will be a really valuable lesson for all of us, but especially for those that may have had some difficulty in court previously. And we always like to hear what Judge Thompson wrote. He's been a guest on Law Talk a number of years ago, and perhaps we can get him back on. Following that, we're going to talk about something called property exemptions. And the scenario here is that A, sues B and gets the judgment against B. B doesn't pay. So A applies to the court for what's called a property execution and goes after money that B has in bank accounts. Well, do they get to clean out their bank accounts? Are there assets that are exempt from efforts to collect? We're going to go through that, and you'll find out exactly how that works. And if you are on the back end of that, where somebody is trying to collect money from you, this is going to be really helpful because it is not as easy for them to get the money as they think it might be. Now, if we have time, we've got another vignette. It's a real case. This one's from the Honorable Janet Hall, also in the U.S. District Court here in Connecticut. And this vignette stars the following: Christopher Columbus, the city of New Haven, and a group which calls itself the American Italian Women for Greater New Haven. This is a federal court lawsuit, and the only party that I mentioned was who was not represented, Christopher Columbus. If you suspect that this might have had something to do with a statue and perhaps the removal of a statue, you would be right. So make sure you stick with us. We'll explain how that played out and exactly what happens when a group attempts to pursue a claim of that nature. Finally, assuming that we get to it, we're going to do another in our series of COVID-19 lawsuits. Those of you that have been with us for the past several weeks will recognize that a lot of the issues that grew out of the pandemic-related closures are making their way through the courts. And we've talked about restaurants that were unable to pay their rent because of the fact that they were high-end restaurants and all they could do was takeout and curbside dining. Well, the decisions are coming down. It's getting more clear about what happens. And we'll talk about this particular case where a bride-to-be paid substantial deposits to a venue in connection with a wedding and a wedding reception. The wedding was eventually canceled, and we'll talk about what happened to those deposits and why. So we've got a whole lineup of different activities for you. We're here until 1 o'clock today. If you're thinking about giving us a call, not quite sure, well, better to call a little bit earlier than later, because that way we'll make sure that we have sufficient time to deal with your question. And so don't hesitate if you'd like to hear some advice for a question that's specific. Our phone number is 860-522-9842. As I mentioned, and as you have probably figured out, that translates to 860-522-WTIC. Well, we're going to have to take a break in a minute because that's the way the format works. But before we do, let me tell you a little bit more about this topic of calculating damages in a wrongful death claim. I know it sounds a little morbid, but these cases are a regular feature in the courts. A lot of people ask, well, how do you determine what the value of a life is? And we're going to go through that. There are basically four different components to the analysis, and we're going to talk more about them after the break, but I'll just tell you what's coming up and how it works. There's economic damages. There's compensation for the destruction of the capacity to carry out and enjoy life's activities in the way that the person would have had they lived. There's compensation for conscious pain and suffering before death, if that exists in the case. And finally, there's compensation for the death itself. So whether the case is tried to a judge who will apply those different criteria and the evidence that's adduced by the parties to those criteria, or whether it's tried to a jury and the judge will instruct them as to how the jury is to do that, that's how it works out, and we'll get back into greater detail. In the meantime, just wanted to let you know you're listening to Law Talk, WTIC News Talk 1080, and WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. If you know somebody that you think might like to listen and join us, but they're outside the admittedly large signal that we have here for the 50,000-watt Heritage radio station, WTIC.com, and then press on the Listen Live. If they are anywhere on the planet where they can get onto the internet, they can join us. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. We're going to dive into these topics, and we're going to do all of that right after this.
Son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime dude.
All right, welcome back to Law Talk, everybody. I'm Attorney John Matulis. That is Eddie Cochran, just kicking off some seasonal tunes here to get us rolling. Just wanted to let you know that if you've got a legal question, glad to hear from you at 860-522-9842. All right, back to the topics that we're discussing today. First of all, we talked about wrongful death claims. Unfortunate topic, but one that the law has to deal with, as a couple of people have contacted me and said, well, how the heck does the court figure out what somebody's life is worth? Well, we're going to tell you right now, okay? I mentioned that there's four components to it. We'll go into a little more detail. It'll give you a little better idea of how this works out. You'll see that there is a method to this, and I believe it's fair to both sides, both the estate of the person who died and to the person who caused the death. Many of these are accidental. Okay. First of all, component number one. No, before we mention the four components, Connecticut is a little different from some other states. Okay. This claim belongs to the estate of the deceased person, does not belong to a surviving spouse, does not belong to the next of kin. So that's a little bit different. But it also includes features that go beyond just what the estate itself would be entitled to. What does all that mean? Well, let me tell you. We'll start with the four components. Okay, first thing, economic damages. And we're going to use an example here. And our example will be David, okay? David for decedent. David is badly injured in a car accident, and a week later he expires from his injuries. The accident was the fault of the other driver. David's estate brings a lawsuit against the other driver as the responsible party. So what is this case worth, and how does the court make sense of all of this? First of all, economic damages. This is one of the four components of the compensation that David's estate is going to receive. The court has to calculate the value of the decedent's lost earning capacity. Now, I should tell you that when we do these, we generally use an economist, and there's a lot of data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. So if you know someone's age, if you know the extent of their education, if you know what skills or what training they have, there is enough statistical information available through the government from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that allows an economist to project with quite a bit of accuracy what the David in our example was likely to have earned for the rest of his work life. Okay, that's not his life expectancy, it's his work life expectancy. So what happens is the economists calculate how much David would be expected to earn. If he's 40 years old, his earnings are going to be different than if everything else is the same and he's 59 years old, because his work life expectancy will be longer if he's younger. The next thing that gets done is that the law says that you have to subtract out the cost of necessary living expenses. And the economists do this by basically looking at what David's regular living expenses were at the time of his death, and then extrapolating that forward. So you end up with the larger figure reduced by necessary living expenses. And there's also a line that says that it's also reduced by the income taxes that David would likely have been expected to pay. So you end up with this figure, but that figure represents the total amount, the net amount that David would have earned over his work expectancy had he lived. That's not going to be the end of the inquiry. The next thing is that has to be reduced to present dollar value. And the court requires the economist, our expert witness, to use what's called a discount factor. So in other words, you take this admittedly large number and you use a discount factor, which bears a strong relationship to the rate of return that amount of money could reasonably be expected to earn, and you calculate downward to a sum of money today that if you used this discount factor as the rate of return for that going forward would eventually at the end of his work expectancy come up with the amount that would have been the total. So I know that sounds pretty complicated. It's why we do it with economists. That's the first part of the calculation. That's the economic damages, and because it can be calculated, it's basically a hard figure compared to some of the others. And you'll see what I mean when we move on to the second element, okay? And that's compensation for the destruction of David's capacity to carry on and enjoy life's activities in the way that he would have done had he lived. Okay, so, well, what exactly does that mean? So we're going to give you an example here, and this is from a fairly recent decision by Judge Lois Tanzer. I've had the privilege of trying a couple of cases in front of her. She's very thoughtful. She's very thorough, okay? And she's basically explaining here by quoting a couple of Supreme Court decisions how you do this, okay? The parties in a death action are entitled to attempt to present an overall picture of the decedent's activities so that the jury can make an informed valuation of the total destruction of his capacity to carry on life's activities. Okay, so what does that mean? How do you apply that? Here's how you apply it. There's a couple of examples. Evidence bearing on how pleasurable the decedent's future might have been is admissible. Another example, evidence of decedent's attachment to family is relevant to the claim for destruction of capacity to carry on and enjoy life's activities. Okay? In my experience, probably relationship to family and friends and interaction with them is one of the best measures about the destruction of the capacity to carry on pleasurable life activities. What are some others? Well, supposing somebody gets great pleasure out of volunteering at a food bank or something else, the fact that they do that, absolutely admissible because it has bearing on the capacity to carry on and enjoy life's activities. So you've got the interaction with other people. You've got the charitable or volunteer work. What about sports? Sure. Somebody enjoys participating in sports, gives them pleasure, and there's a documented history of that which can be offered through witnesses and other evidence. Yes, that works also. So what about somebody who enjoys sports but likes observing them, watching them, even on television? Yes, if that's an activity which is documented, it gives them pleasure, it's all relevant to the question of how pleasurable the decedent's future might have been. So you can see that this is, in contrast to economic damages, it's a much more subjective calculation, and this is where the lawyer's craft comes into being, okay? This is where lawyers that do this well can make the judge, if it's tried to the judge, or the jury, if it's tried to the jury, really understand what's been taken away from this person, and then how it is that you quantify that. Okay, so those are several different aspects of compensation for the destruction of the capacity to carry on and enjoy life's activities. Next one here, compensation for conscious pain and suffering before death. Remember that in our example, David was horribly injured in the car accident. He expired a week later. If there is evidence that he had regained consciousness or was conscious through there, evidence of conscious pain and suffering is completely admissible. How do you prove that? You prove it from two ways. People that actually observed it. This can be nurses caring for him at bedside if he was able to express conscious pain and suffering. The second way is you use medical professionals, especially emergency room personnel, and they can offer an opinion based upon reasonable medical probability whether a person suffering from those particular injuries would be likely to experience conscious pain and suffering. The last one, of course, is compensation for death itself. And that one seems to be a lot more subjective, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of guidance. I will tell you that as a young lawyer, we once argued the compensation for conscious pain and suffering on a crashed airplane case. Small airplane going down, said that they knew they were going to crash, must have been scared to death, saw their life passing in front of them. Judge said, nothing doing. How are you going to prove that? No survivors, and the person's dead. Anyway, that's the rundown on that. I'm attorney John Matulis. You're listening to Law Talk, and we'll be back after news.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome back to Law Talk, right here on WTIC News Talk 1080. I'm attorney John Matulis. We are with you right up until 1 o'clock. We're delighted to take your calls regarding legal questions, legal issues. Mrs. Rodriguez in Hartford, we're going to get to you shortly. And we've got a line or two open for you also at 860-522-9842. We are here until 1 o'clock, and then it's news, sports, weather, and pet talk. So if you're thinking about giving us a call, better to do it a little bit sooner than a little bit later. Before we get to a caller, though, I just wanted to remind you that if you don't have a lawyer and you're looking for some good, high-quality legal advice, the Hartford County Bar Association operates a not-for-profit lawyer referral service. It is a good deal, okay? You call them up at the phone number I'm going to give you in just a moment, and they'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the nature of your legal issue or your legal inquiry. You then get referred to an attorney that practices in the proper discipline to help with your specific issue. But these aren't garden variety attorneys who just sign up. They are vetted, so they are insured. They are experienced. They are free of disciplinary problems. And if you're thinking of hiring a lawyer off a billboard or off an internet ad, there's a lot of them that will not meet those three qualifications. So what does all this cost you, and what do you get? First of all, You get a half-hour consult for $35, and that goes to pay a portion of the cost of operating this not-for-profit program. There's office space rental, there's staff salaries, there's phone service, so the fee goes to subsidize some of those expenses. But if you're calling about a personal injury claim that you have, they will waive the $35 fee. Okay, if you're calling about a workers' compensation claim that you have, no $35 fee for you either, no fee at all. Last one, you got a Social Security disability claim or an issue about that, same thing, no fee for you. Now, at the end of the half hour, no further obligations whatsoever. No hard sell about further services. If you and the attorney decide that further services are requested and you want to proceed forward with each other, that's up to the two of you. If not, that's fine also. So how do you access this? You access this by calling them at, and get your pencils out, 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. They have a substantial number of attorneys that have been screened, vetted, and who participate in this program. Once again, it's a great deal. We recommend it highly. It's the Hartford County Bar Association's lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. If you give them a try, tell them you heard about it on Law Talk, okay? In the meantime, let's get back to the phones. You got a legal question. We are at 860-522-9842. First up, Mrs. Rodriguez in Hartford. Hi, thanks for holding on, and you're on the air. All right, let's see if we got it now. Mrs. Rodriguez, you're on the air, and it's Law Talk. How can we help you? Oh, well, and she just hung up, so I guess we're going to be moving on further. I've got a couple of lines open. Delighted to hear from you. In the meantime, I want to tell you about the story that we led up to before. And this is if you've been in trouble once in court, and now it's 20 years later, and you're in court again, is this going to come back to bite you? Well, this is a case, and this was from the federal court, and the decision is by the Honorable Alvin Thompson, and he has been a guest on Law Talk here in the past, so I'm very happy to take a look at this. This is a case called Mindling versus Steigler, and here's the backstory, okay? Mr. Steigler was involved in a dissolution of marriage action with his ex-wife a number of years ago. He testified in that case. The judge wrote a decision. The judge wrote in the decision that Mr. Steigler's testimony was not credible, and further, that he made this non-credible testimony and claims in an effort to deceive the court. Okay? It had to do with whether or not he could afford child support. So he gets this taint that comes up. Now, fast forward 20 years later, now we've got a case called Natasha Mindling or Mindling versus George Steigler Jr., same exact defendant. Mr. Steigler's attorneys become aware that the plaintiff, Ms. Mindling, intends to bring up the decision of the judge from 20 years before in that dissolution of marriage action, where the judge made a finding of fact that his testimony was not credible and that he made the testimony in an effort to deceive the court. Bad, bad things and found by the judge. Well, those of us that have had some training in evidence, our knee-jerk reaction is, well, not admissible, not relevant to the issues before the court here, not the same parties, and we don't know what the basis was for the court's previous ruling. So, what happens here? Well, Judge Thompson issues a ruling. He takes a look at this, and he basically says, well, we got a federal rule of evidence, and it's Rule 608, and it basically says that the court may allow people to inquire into extrinsic evidence to prove specific instances of a witness's conduct in order to attack or support the witness's character for truthfulness. Uh-oh, all of a sudden, not looking so good for Mr. Steigler. So where does all of that take us? Well, Judge Thompson points out a number of different cases where this has come up and where, in many cases, the questions that were going to be asked did not relate to the events of the case before the court, but other courts have concluded that those questions did relate to character for truthfulness. So in this particular case here, the end result was, yes, indeed, the trial judge's decision, it was Judge Hiller in the state court, was supported by the record and sound reasoning. There was no need to review the entire record, nor has Mr. Steigler pointed to some material portion of the record that was inconsistent with the judge's finding. So, what's the takeaway on this one? First of all, Mr. Steigler is going to have his character for truthfulness dragged across the courtroom floor, and the plaintiff's attorneys, Natasha Mindling is her name, are going to try and show that he has no credibility and that nothing that he says should be believed, let alone be persuasive to the court. So the story here is, if you ever get into difficulty at court, especially in family court, where there are formal findings of testimony not being credible, let alone findings that you gave the non-credible testimony in an effort to deceive the court, that can mysteriously reappear out of the past and come back to bite you in the future. So you might ask, well, 20 years later, how did this other woman know all about this? The decision points out Natasha Mindling was the stepdaughter of George Steigler. So in all likelihood, she was the daughter of the ex-spouse, where the trial in state court led to Judge Hiller making these findings of a total lack of credibility and a willingness and intent to deceive the court. So as far as Judge Thompson is concerned, the federal rules permit Ms. Mindling's attorneys to bring that up. And while Mr. Steigler's attorneys will certainly have the opportunity to try to either explain it or put it into context, it's reminiscent of something I learned as a young lawyer when trying a case in federal court with several defendants. One of the other attorneys argued about evidence that was not admissible. He said, "Your Honor, you can't unring a bell." So if something gets in that has a negative effect, even if there is an instruction to the jury to disregard it, remember, you can't unring a bell. So in this particular case, we are in the federal court. It's a single docket situation when the case of Natasha Mindling versus George Steigler Jr. proceeds further, especially if there's going to be testimony from George Steigler Jr. This case will be handled by the exact same judge, the Honorable Alvin Thompson, who made the ruling here permitting this type of information to go forward. The takeaway from that is, if you ever find yourself in George Steigler Jr.'s position as a result of some court not believing you and actually putting it into the decision, number one, it may very well come back to bite you, notwithstanding the passage of time or any of the other reasons why it is that under traditional concepts of admissibility, it would be irrelevant and improper. And number two, you'd better be prepared to try to explain it or in some other fashion minimize the impact of it, because otherwise it looks like in a battle of credibility, you're not going to do so well. We're going to be back with more of Law Talk, but the format says it's time for a break, and so does Tom, my producer, the boss. You're listening to Law Talk on WTIC, News Talk 1080, and WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. Me, I'm attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and we'll be back with more Law Talk right after this. Yes, enjoying the tunes. Okay, welcome back to Law Talk. I'm attorney John Matulis, and that is Santana. We are here right up until 1 o'clock today, and we're dispensing legal information, legal advice, a little bit of all of the above. There's still time if you have a legal question and you'd like us to discuss it with you, give you some guidance. Give us a call at 860-522-WTIC. That's 860-522-9842. All right, I told you earlier we're going to talk about exemptions, and this is basically something that might be very, very practical, especially if any of you find that there's been a judgment entered against you. So here's our example. Peter sues Donna. Peter is the plaintiff, Donna's the defendant, and so you can see the pattern here. Peter receives a judgment that Donna owes him money. Donna doesn't pay. It might even be a default judgment where she didn't defend herself. So now it falls to Peter to try and collect on the judgment. There's a couple of different things that Peter can do. One of them is if Donna is working, he can ask the court to issue what's called a wage garnishment. And a wage garnishment is an order from the court that goes to a marshal. And it directs the marshal to go to Donna's place of employment and serve the execution upon her employer. Now, that means that Donna's wages, not all of them, but a portion of them, are going to be diverted to the marshal, who is going to collect those on behalf of Peter, the plaintiff, who has the unpaid judgment. A couple of things to watch out for here. First of all, the marshal is entitled to and will collect 15% for his or her services. And the 15% is in addition to the amount of the judgment and costs awarded by the court. So if you happen to be on the wrong end of one of these, and all of a sudden you find you have a notice that your wages are being garnished, you need to sit up and pay attention to what I'm going to be telling you in a moment, because you have options. Another thing to keep in mind is that you are limited, the plaintiff who is trying to get your money from your paycheck is limited. The law says that you multiply 40, like in 40 hours per week, times the current minimum hourly wage. Just for the sake of simple math, say it's $10 an hour, that's $400. So the result from that multiplication is an amount of money that is exempt from execution. So supposing in our example, Donna was netting $600 a week after her exemptions and deductions and everything else, she would still get to keep $400, but $200 of it would be diverted from the employer to the marshal, who collects the amount of the judgment plus the 15% fee. The marshal then turns the money over to Peter, the plaintiff, the judgment creditor in our example. Okay? Now, here comes some of the meat of this, and this is where I think this can be very, very helpful for you. Not all assets are subject to being seized with an execution like this. We've talked about the limitation on the wages, but there are other limitations also, and they're very important to know about them. They can't just go out and grab property out of your house. There's a lot of exemptions. So here's the important thing, especially if you are in the position of Donna, the defendant in our example. You have rights to property that is exempt from execution. Similarly, if you're in the position of Peter, the plaintiff, who's trying to collect this unpaid judgment, there are certain assets out there that Donna may have which you're not going to be able to reach. So where do we find out what the assets are which are exempt? Well, there's a specific statute, because there usually is. And for those of you keeping score at home, this one is called Section 52-352B, as in baby, of our general statutes. Now, in there are 22 separate categories of exemptions. Some of them are obvious. The marshal cannot grab bedding, food, furniture. You know, those are really basics of life. No matter how much you owe, they can't touch that. Another example, tools, books, can't touch them. Burial plot, Can't touch it, although you would wonder why somebody might want to do that. But I guess if it can be turned into cash, people would do it. If you are receiving welfare payments, those are exempt, okay? Wedding and engagement rings, those may have a fairly significant value. They're exempt. They cannot grab those in order to pay a debt, okay? Alimony payments that you may be receiving, also exempt. Now, the practical point here is that if a bank account which contains any of these exempt sources of income is levied upon by the marshal, you've got the right to go to court and to have the exemption lifted, okay? Now, the way that you do that is the papers that are served on you are going to tell you that you have 20 days in which to notify the court that you're claiming an exemption for the property. And so there's a form, you fill it out, you send it in, the court's going to have a hearing. So against that backdrop, we're going to tell you the story of the Commissioner of Revenue Services versus Mr. McCarthy. Okay, McCarthy owed money to the Commissioner of Revenue Services. In all likelihood, this was taxes, but whatever it was, it doesn't matter for purposes of this example, and it doesn't really matter that it was the Commissioner of Revenue Services. In our example, this could still be Paul the plaintiff or Peter the plaintiff, whoever we named him, and it could still be Donna the defendant. So here's what happened, okay? McCarthy's funds in his bank account were levied upon by a marshal, and they were turned over to the Commissioner of Revenue Services to satisfy this debt. Well, McCarthy, at about the same time, lost his job. So he argued that the funds in his bank account were exempt on the basis of the fact that it was unemployment benefits. Therefore, turning over the funds before an exemption hearing warranted immediate release of the funds. Now, I think I mentioned, but I'll repeat, that what is also exempt from execution, workers' compensation payments you receive, exempt, cannot touch them. Social Security benefits that you receive, exempt, cannot touch them. And here's the one that McCarthy was relying upon. Well, veterans' benefits, also similarly exempt. Unemployment compensation benefits. That's what McCarthy seized upon here. And he said, well, I'm unemployed, and therefore the money in my bank account should be exempt. So he sent in the paperwork. There was a hearing. The court basically looked at this, and what did they tell McCarthy? They told him, first of all, that it's unemployment compensation payments which are exempt. It is not his status as a recently unemployed person, or for that matter, as a not so recently unemployed person. So the end result was as follows. First of all, his claim of exemption was denied. The reason is because even though it's true that he was recently unemployed, he had not yet started to receive the benefits. Therefore, the money in his bank account could not have been the proceeds from unemployment compensation. And because he did not claim any other exemption, the money was not exempt. Now, the court did him a favor. They did one thing here which is helpful and which he apparently did not know. There is what is referred to among those 22 different categories of exemptions as what is called a wildcard exemption, which means that the first $1,000 that you have of an asset which would otherwise not be exempt is covered. It just blank exemption. So the court said, even though you haven't asked for it, we will order that the first $1,000 in your bank account is exempt anyway under this wild card exemption. And the rest of it, unfortunately, goes to the Commissioner of Revenue Services. Now, that music in the background is my cue to wrap up yet another Law Talk. It has been a pleasure to be back with you live and in person, as we will be on future Saturdays. Thank you for listening. Thank you also to Tom, our producer. He is the guy that gets the credit if the program sounds okay. If there's any shortfalls or shortcomings, that would be with me. Me, I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and we'll see you next Saturday.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.